Love is the relationship between a grown-up man and a grown-up woman.
Okay,
I'll take that.
And this is a rather dull definition.
Well, let's take off from that. Actually, when you consider how we describe love in our popular songs or...
Clifton Fadiman is our host. His guests are Miss Faye Emerson, the beautiful actress and columnist, Alastair Cook, distinguished journalist and host of the television program Omnibus, and Dr. Gregory Zilborg, psychiatrist and author of Psychology of the Criminal Act and Punishment. This conversation started several minutes ago, and as we turn up our microphones, our conversationalists are deep in a discussion of love in America. Faye Emerson is speaking.
When you speak of love, and I will agree with the good doctor that it's a highly overworked word because it is one of the constants. It's one of the real truths. There have been two great stories, I think, since people started writing down stories on the walls of caves, and that's the bravery of man and his love. Now, this is the one thing that hasn't changed, and no matter how we explore the motives or the minds or the ids or the egos of men, we find one thing, that when he's least expected to do it and will gain nothing from it, he's brave. And that no matter how clever he is in trying to avoid it or think above it, he will fall in love. And these two things never change.
No, as far as conduct is concerned, they don't change. Do you think that we fall in love in any different way in our country than in any other way?
No, I think we regard it differently.
If you are speaking of romantic love as the type of attitude that people have of being attracted to one another and then sentimentalize it, then you are lost, because it's the same thing everywhere for centuries and centuries and millions of years.
You don't think that we have any special predilection for, let's say, a kind of sentimental adulation of the...
That is a different story. You see, in this country, there is always an attitude of sentimentalization of love, because we have not yet outgrown the stage of what I call the hit song.
I was going to talk about that. How about the hit song kind of love?
The hit song is not a kind of love. How about the kind of love that the hit song pretends to describe? That's a different story.
And that doesn't exist, you think?
That doesn't exist. You see, children have a very interesting attitude. They sometimes tell you a lie. And you know that the child lies, but you feel that the child is not dishonest. The child merely adds to its reality something that it misses, so it supplies it with its own fantasy, which is called, at this level, lying, denying reality, and filling it in with its own fantasy.
Well, a pop song is that kind of lying?
And
is
this
mean?
Is the kind
it's the next step,
fantasy.
You mean?
Yes, not the next step, that's the undoubtedly that, because
right.
The greatest majority of people who live on the level of mature love have no need to sentimentalize it any more than a truly religious man has a need to emotionalize his faith.
Nevertheless, would you not be willing to admit, and Alistair, don't you think this is conceivably true, that even though our popular songs and torch songs and all that sort of thing may be synthetic and may deal with, as Gregory says, with an illusion, with an immature illusion too, nevertheless, isn't it true that people tend to model their conduct to some extent on what the popular song says?
I think the symbolic image of the hit song is what my wife calls, with great contempt, the drugstore beauty. You see, and she always says that I fall for this, because it's essential when you switch countries to be able to fit in with the vices of the country you assume.
Rather than the virtues.
And I must say that to me, I've listened to this with a little disquiet, because I think the whole romantic conception of the hit song, of the torch singer, the nightclub's purple spot, the special gown, the Hollywood grooming, is true if you think it is. And the thing that always astonishes me is the number of Americans who not only think it is, but go out to get it, and get it.
I happen to be in favor of good, gross, actual reality rather than a fantasy.
Isn't it true that it leads to an extraordinary amount of disillusionment? Young gals and young boys really expect their mates when they marry them to be as charming, let's say, as Van Johnson or Ava Gardner or Marilyn Monroe.
Your fantasies to yourself.
Or indeed, Faye Emerson. And gosh, most of us, beginning with me, can't measure up to these, paragons of charm. Doesn't it lead to an awful lot of discontent among young people when they find out that the movie ideal just doesn't exist?
But I don't think that the movies or television or radio are nearly as much to blame for this whole situation of over-sentimentalized or over-romanticized ideas of love as perhaps the advertisers of America.
Doesn't it come down to the notion that there's somehow a formula for being
lovable?
There's
a formula for being happy. Now, I don't believe that that's true, and I don't think it's that simple, but in this country, I say this country, this is one fault, I think, is that we've made love very commercial. We've put it on a commercial basis. We say, if you wear so-and-so's gowns and you use so-and-so's toothpaste and shampoo, you will be so exquisite that the man that is right for you, and it probably won't be the man that's right for you, will come along and you will marry him, and that will be the end of it.
I found that just isn't true.
I don't believe that's true. I think that love is just as adult and mature in this country as it is anywhere else. The emphasis has only been slightly wrong.
It seems to me that that what we fail to do is to make a distinction between being lovable and being attractive. Mm. A woman, for example, may be extremely attractive in the sense that all men look at her as she passes by, but she may not, upon closer intimacy, be lovable at all.
What you're talking about right now is not love at all.
Why not?
Fadiman, why you don't talk about love? You an intelligent man like that, I don't know. You're talking about being excited about a girl. You're talking about becoming excited about a boy.
And that's usually a prerequisite, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, now wait a moment. This is not a prerequisite. A prerequisite of love is the presence of excitement. But excitement is not a generator of love. The issue then is this, that all these things that Faye Emerson just described, and very well described, is only a phenomenon in which people believe that love is reduced to a state of being excited by one another.
Now, I think that what Faye was talking about was something a little less concrete than that. She was merely saying, it seems to me, that the advertisers put too much emphasis on merely mechanical modes of making yourself attractive, that's all. And I think, on the whole, that's true. Alistair, do you disagree about that?
Well, I've been thinking while this has been going on that it reminds me of the old days, way back there, to everybody except Miss Emerson.
Nice of you.
That's the English
When we used to thrash...
I'm blushing.
We used to thrash over this great problem of the difference between, usually with your first girl, of the difference between being in love and loving. And if there is any validity in it at all, I'd say that there is no trouble whatever in America in exciting people to fall in love, and that they can have a rip-roaring time in their 20s, probably very unphilosophical and probably very Freudian in a naturalistic way. But I would think that the statistics showed that the problems of love in America set in when people are required to be happy in their 40s and 50s.
Yes, well, let me put the question to you all then. Do you think Americans, and that's us around this table, really think of creating love in marriage as a lifetime job? Most of us, I think, and this is what Alistair is saying, are pretty good at it for the first year or two, and then we fail to continue to give to the business of creating a love atmosphere in the home
because
the energy and work which it needs.
Because I think of the explosion of Faye's picture of what she calls the advertiser's product, and I call the drugstore beauty.
Exactly, exactly, Alistair. I was agreeing with you that this is a false premise that has been presented as love. This is not love, of course. This is all the beginnings of love. This is these things maybe are all right for 17-year-olds if we said to them, all right, consider this only a 17-year-old idea, but beyond that we must go into what love really is. I don't think you can put it down to this automatic reflex or that impulse. I think it is a mystic thing. For instance, we were talking about torch songs, and what was it? Was it Noel Coward who said the terrible power of cheap popular
cheap
songs?
Music. Mm.
Cheap music. Cheap
true,
popular
too.
Songs. But you know something? I think you've got it backwards. It isn't that the song inspires an emotion. of love, but it recalls one.
I think they're not models of conduct, then, but just exercises in recollection. It's just possible that we enjoy being continually young in our lovemaking.
No, you have such a sort of semi-sophisticated way of being simple, Vaderman.
No, I haven't even got a simple way of being semi-sophisticated.
That is absolutely true. That I agree with you. But you see, the thing is this. When people, and this again will perhaps arouse the reproach that I simplify things, but as a scientist, I've got to reduce things to their elements, otherwise you'll never understand anything. You see, if in every person there is a craving to recapture the good old days, old people are given to reminiscences, they don't live in the present. But when a young, vigorous nation like America shows this tendency of sentimentalizing and always returning to this sentimentalization.
You think that's decadent?
No.
Dangerous?
No, I merely say that shows that there is a tendency in the greatest majority of these people, regardless what causes it, to remain on the juvenile level. And what is characteristic of the juvenile level when we speak about love?
A plethora of psychiatrists.
I would say, sir, it's the wonderful thing of going back to a lack of responsibility,
exactly,
of not having to face up.
Not give anything, being excited, live on the very throb of living without having any understanding of the implications of the totality of life, no philosophies about it.
Yeah.
Now, in other words, it is being a child, being a boy, being a juvenile, mm-hmm, personality.
Oh, I think that one of the troubles I'm told about American marriage is that business offers too much competition to love. Actually, business life in America is so interesting. It offers so much opportunity for interesting experience and for unusual conflict that a man who is in love beautifully and excitedly in his early 20s soon finds that as he gets into his 30s, the lure of competition, of the aggressive business life, gets more interesting than creating a home in which there is love.
Oh,
Faye, you say no?
I disagree. Many of the people whose lives are not perhaps wrecked, but who've gotten off the track and are emotionally and basically deeply unhappy, is because they have no real anchor. They may be very successful financially, in a business way, or in their artistic life, but they have no anchor. And by anchor, I think they almost always mean love.
The thing that interests me about this whole topic is this. We've agreed that all races and all nations are the same in their potential, that a man and a woman in Tibet, and an Eskimo and a man in New Jersey, are capable of the same kinds of love and the same kinds of mistakes. But the thing that intrigues me is that down the centuries, human beings with essentially the same ability to live a rich or a poverty-stricken life, emotionally, set themselves in society totally different conventions of what is acceptable, of what is good. Now, among the Greeks, the mature love of two grown and philosophic men was not only admirable, it was the highest form of love. And we shouldn't shun that. The Romans felt the same. Now, jump to our day, you say, well, that's ancient history. In Britain, I know so many people who started far away from the drugstore ideal. They said, well, you know, I'm not handsome and you're not pretty, but we're kind of cozy together in the evenings. Do you think we could make a go of it? And they get married. The times when English marriages crumble are in the first few years. If they get into 10 years or into their 30s, they think, isn't it marvelous that we stayed together? They begin to love each other more and more. And to an outsider, the basis of their love is pathetic. But it's good for them, and it's so different from America.
We come back to the word, then, that I think is so important in love, that almost is the same word as love, I think, and that is friend. This is my friend. This understands me, this man, this woman. I love them because they love me, and we are alike. I think that's important. Do you remember the most adult movie, I think, about love? One of the most charming was
Brief
Encounter. About the meeting of two people, grown people, very mature people, who were not particularly attractive. And that movie made so much money over here because people recognized that as a basic truth.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best television shows ever done was a show called Marty. It was written by Paddy Chayefsky, I think. I hope I'm not wrong on this. But the premise of this hour-long dramatic show was that two terribly unattractive people met, and there was a pathos in this and a kind of loneliness, and it was very moving and wonderful. They're now making it into a picture. Hmm. Now, what I say was wrong in our conception of it here was that they had to be ugly people. Why did they have to go that far to make this love story believable?
They could
have been just normal, not normally unattractive, just regular people. We're not all beautiful and glamorous. We're not a race of supermen and superwomen. We're people like everywhere else. Some of us are short and fat, and some of us are tall and skinny. But all of us have one thing that I think, Doctor, I'd love to hear what you say about this. I think that it's my belief, knowing nothing about it, that that's one of man's primary needs. To eat, to sleep, to make love in the other sense, in the animal sense, the purely physical sense, but another primary need is to belong.
Here is the difference between my experience, let's say, and yours. My experience comes from the direct knowledge of the human being in the raw and its depth.
Mm-hmm.
Your experience comes from a great many other sources, overwhelmingly from other sources. I was fascinated with what you, Miss Emerson, have to say, because intuitively, you seem to put a very proper, correct evaluation on what the trouble is. I agree with you. But you seem to, as all people who are afraid of psychiatrists, to disagree the moment I open my mouth.
Say isn't afraid of anything.
So for a moment, don't disagree, and perhaps at the end we might agree.
Mm-hmm.
Take the most rigid attitudes towards love that we know in civilization. There are two. One is absolute puritanism,
mm-hmm.
which is the reverse aspect of asceticism,
mm-hmm.
and is not very human because it's cruel. And the other is the traditional attitude of let's say Catholicism or Anglicanism, in which it speaks of love in the highest sense of the word, but emphasizes marriage and family as an absolute component of love. You see, what I'm trying to say then is this. Yes, the sense of belonging, the sense of oneness, the sense of not being alone, the sense of in a moment of sadness, to find that just getting a pat on the shoulder or a touch of the hand for some reason makes you feel easier.
Gregory, that's what Alistair was saying when he was describing the happy, serene, harmonious, perhaps not enormously exciting.
But it is very exciting because those people have a sense of oneness, not only with one another, but the oneness with the world.
With the world.
They walk out in the streets and they don't feel lost. Now, the secret of it lies in this. And this, I think, is the major trouble with this country. Whether you call it the drugstore type of beauty, whether you call it the commercialized type of exciting torch singer and so forth, we separate. Like the youngster who is excited, we separate the sexual aspect of love from love in the broader and a deeper sense. We remain on that level, we sentimentalize it, commercialize it, because we've got to have 3.5 million to 5.5 million people to look at that thing, and the greatest majority of people are best reached when you reach them at the juvenile level rather than an adult level.
Well, that's quite an indictment, Gregory. I'd like to ask Alistair, who has an objective point of view and who is a very sober analyst of our country, whether he agrees with what Gregory has just said.
Well, I think that like so many things that are indicted and in fact convicted as pure essence of Americanism, I think we can trick these things, we can package them better than other nations, but that they're quite universal. One of the things that is very striking, and I was back in England this summer, is to find that all these problems, all these things that are so discredited and so lamented in the United States, exist in a kind of shambling, fumbling, amateur, raging form all over England.
We do wrong things better, you mean. It seems to me that both of you are being a little unfair to our country here. I think there are a great many mature, adult examples of love and companionship, sometimes among people who are married, sometimes among people who are not married. Those are not the kind of love relationships that make the headlines. The trouble is that the only kind of love about which we make generalizations in this country is the kind of love that's well advertised. I was thinking, for example,
it's true.
Let's take two very nice young people that I happen to be reading about, Faye. I know one of them, and
Eddie
I'm sure.
Fisher.
Yes, Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds. I don't know Miss Reynolds, but I know Eddie, and he's a fine young boy. He's a young boy,
mm-hmm.
and he's a boy,
mm-hmm.
and nothing wrong with that. But the romance, and goodness knows we wish them all good fortune. The little romance that they are having, which is precisely the same kind of nice, fine, decent, good romance that all young people have, is being so widely publicized that somehow it seems to me to cheapen the whole business of romance.
Well,
now, this isn't the fault of Eddie or Debbie, who are awfully nice kids.
Certainly
it's the fault of our method of multiplying, of mass communicating an unimportant, though pleasant, private experience until everybody has to know all about it.
That's true.
But
look at it this way. The thing that I think is so unhappy about this and that is wrong about it is that now if Eddie and Debbie, Fisher and Reynolds that is, decide to have what is perfectly normal in any relationship between two people, their own private quarrels, and it won't be a healthy relationship unless they do. I think I'm a firm believer of saying what is on your mind and getting it out of your system, and they have their own little quarrel, they'll have not much chance to get through it and back to each other again, as we all do normally, because it will be so...
Headlined.
So headlined, yeah. Exactly.
Faye, I don't know how celebrities can ever have a mature love affair for that reason. It's kind of hard.
But you're talking of America is made up of celebrities only. Let's talk about common people.
I know, but my point is this.
But they get through their fights.
My point is that ordinary people like myself and millions of others do take our cue in part from what we hear and what we read about. We can't help it. These are our heroes. What is a hero? Somebody one hears about. It's not the anonymous man. It's the one who is on the front pages of the papers.
I am feeling very humble after your rejecting the indictment that was brought by...
I'd like to qualify it.
Dr. Silberg and myself. And I think you're very right, because it just struck me that what were the examples that I took from another civilization? They were from the highest point of its literature, you know, from Rome, from Virgil. And then what you compare it with? You compare it with the Marvel...
News out of Hollywood.
The Hollywood gossip columnist, which tells us something about our capacity to advertise and publicize things, and not possibly about what is the normal experience of love in this country. I would like to say on this point that I think that it's very striking, I think, to a European, how a great many Americans, and presumably the big body of Americans, you can see it in gossip columns and you can see it from the records of marriage counselors, at least know that marriage is a thing that has to be worked on. They, I would say, suffer from what I, in a cynical way, might consider the delusion, but I think it's a very noble delusion, that happiness is a manageable thing. And I think the thing that the American, who is essentially still an optimist, still staking out frontiers and trying to conquer them, what he suffers from is, because of this belief in the manageability of happiness, is that you can work it all out so that the marriage will go along 100%. And I think in the older, more fatalistic nations, they settle for 50%, which may be wrong in them.
But more practical, you think?
Well, not necessarily more practical. I think less noble, less idealistic, certainly.
Yes. Faye has something she wanted to comment
on. Oh, I'm so pleased to hear you say that, Alistair, because I think that's true. When we talk about, for instance, our over-commercialization in this country of the idea of love and romantic happiness in marriage, I think we underestimate, as always, the American attribute to saying it can be done. You take the average American girl. There is no average, we know that, but for purposes of this argument, we will take the average American. Because she reads about so-and-so's soap and so-and-so's shampoo, and because our great know-how has made it possible for almost the poorest people in this country to be able to afford those things at the dime stores if they don't get it at Elizabeth Arden's, She is attractive. She doesn't have to have the fatalistic attitude of the European or the Asiatic or the woman in the rest of the world. She not only does know that about how to make herself more attractive, but she also has, as a general rule, more schooling. Now, I'm not talking about your higher classes in other countries, your more older civilizations, perhaps, but I'm just saying the average American girl or boy has more schooling. Their minds are opened up to the fact that maybe there is a way to find an answer. Now, I think the answer to it is that American families, for instance, are getting larger. They're having more children. It used to be during the really neurotic days of the 20s and the early 30s that families got smaller and smaller. Now, the American is saying, all right, we'll set this as our norm. We won't reach that, but let's get as close to it as we can. We'll try and work this out. We'll build our family life. America is at least making the step. I think the step that must be made, of course, basically is a mental and spiritual one.
I've often thought that we have examinations, for example, for people who want to be electricians or plumbers. They have to pass courses, and then they get a kind of certificate which enables them to be a licensed electrician.
Not a good electrician, just licensed.
But at least they know something about electricity, but we never really get a man and a woman to pass any kind of courses before they get married. I don't mean that they should go to school, but isn't marriage kind of a hard job?
Well, but of course you do make that examination.
But I
everyone does inside. There are very few people, even runaway marriages, when you don't say to yourself, is this right? And I think there are very few people cynical enough to marry thinking, if this doesn't work, I can get out of it. Most people really basically say to themselves, this is maybe the most important step of my life. They really try, I think.
Well, I think they do.
At the moment. And that's the kind of examination you pass.
But often they're incapable, particularly at a very young age, of making the constant series of difficult adjustments that marriage requires and
that's
the
true.
Continuous creation of
that's
love
true.
Requires. I often think, to come back to your Greeks, Alistair, Aristotle, I think it was, that said that a man should be 35 and a woman 28 before a marriage should be solemnized.
But nature says no.
Nature does say no, but Aristotle says yes.
No, nature says no to a legal contract. Nature has nothing to do with legal contracts. I mean, it's...
It was his idea.
Society says
Aristotle's idea was very simple. He thought that marriage was a hard job, that it required a certain amount of what Dr. Zilborg
come
means.
To your maturity.
Yes, maturity. The absence of juvenility, and he thought that, on the whole, young people in their early 20s didn't have it. Now, we don't believe that to be true. We may be right, but I just want to remind you that there's another way of looking at marriage.
The issue, we now we drifted towards marriage and family. You notice how we drifted from love, from the drugstore, finally, into a sacramental sort of
union. Well, I think the drift is very natural.
I don't object.
I think love does lead to marriage.
I merely say, look, we drifted. I don't say it's unnatural. After all, we're all four natural human beings. But we drifted not accidentally. We drifted into this particular theme because we found that the way of looking at the thing, the way we looked at the beginning of the evening, led only to superficial conclusions and superficial visualization of human emotions.
Our host was Clifton Fadiman, author, critic, and regular essayist for Holiday magazine.